Hi, Active History is pleased to present a recording of Commemorations in the National Capital Region, Evolution and Finance. This roundtable was chaired by Yves Fournette and was held as part of the Canadian Historical Association annual meeting. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.
Bonsoir, je m'appelle Yves Fournette, je suis le président sortant et très sortant du comité des interventions publiques à la Société historique du Canada et j'ai l'honneur de présider cette séance ce soir intitulée Commémoration dans la région de la capitale nationale, évolution et constat, Commémoration de la National Capital Region, Evolution Finding. Le conseil d'administration de la Société historique a pensé il y a quelques mois déjà que ce serait une bonne idée de profiter du passage du congrès de la société à Ottawa pour organiser cette table ronde parce que peut-être plus auparavant la commémoration, les commémorations, les monuments dans la région internationale ont suscité l'intérêt du public. So we decided to organize an event and We are very happy and very happy to welcome the four people who will reflect on the situation. They will reflect tout haut. And I will je vais vous les présenter dans l'ordre où ils vont faire des présentations. The week will work. Each of them will do a 10-minute presentation. Then I'm going to ask them questions coming from their presentation. They will discuss among each other, and then it would be la salle pourra réagir. Alors, mon premier intervenant va être Alain Roy. Alain Roy, après avoir complété une maîtrise en histoire à Laval en 1995, une maîtrise qui portait sur la construction du Vieux-Québec en tant que lieu de mémoire nationale, il s'est spécialisé dans les phénomènes de mémoire et de patrimoine. Je ne ferai pas la liste des rapports et des dans ce domaine. Il a été, avant d'émigrer dans la région de la capitale nationale, il a été un intervenant majeur dans le monde, sur l'étude de la mémoire et du patrimoine dans la ville de Québec et plus généralement au Québec. Il s'est intéressé au patrimoine, à la mémoire, à la francophonie, ainsi qu'au patrimoine d'hier. Il a publié de nombreux articles dans le cadre d'un vaste projet franco-québécois. Québécois sur les lieux de mémoire en Nouvelle-France. Il a assumé la co-direction d'un volume. Actuellement, Alain est à l'emploi de la Bibliothèque et Archives Canada. Les opinions qu'il va nous présenter aujourd'hui, ses réflexions, n'engagent que lui, bien sûr, et n'engagent pas la Bibliothèque et Archives Canada. The second person who is going to speak will be Alan Gordon, who is a professor of history at the University of Guelph, the editor of the Urban History Review. Alan holds degrees from Queen's University and the University of Toronto, and he has published extensively on historical commemorations and the public uses of history. He's the author of two books, Making Public Past, The Contested Terrain of Montreal's Public Memory, that has become a classic in the field of the politics of memory, and The Hero and the Historian, Historiography and the Uses of Jean Cartier, en 2010, as well as a third book on the rise of living history museums in Canada, that is currently in production and should be to see the light of day in the spring of 2016. Notre troisième intervenante sera Nadine Bloomer, qui est docteur en sociologie de l'Université de Toronto, qui est présentement stagiaire postdoctoral à l'Université Concordia. She is affiliated with the Center for Ethnographic Research and Exhibition in the Aftermath of Violence. She's conducting research on the Canadian Museum for Human Rights and the memorial landscape in Ottawa. She has a forthcoming article in the Review of Education, Pedagogy, and Cultural Studies. And in this article and in her previous research on commemoration of the Roma Holocaust. Nadine studies sites of cultural production such as museums, monuments, heritage tourism, in order to understand why societies remember some histories of violence while ignoring others. She was previously a research fellow at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington when she started a book called Disentangling Hierarchies of Victimhood, How Germany Commemorates the Nazi Genocide of the Roma. Et finalement, David Akin, who is a Gemini Award journalist who has spent the last decade covering federal politics from Parliament Hill. Prior to that, he spent more than a decade covering technology and internet issues. Today, he's the Parliamentary Bureau Chief for some media, but he works for many other publications and media outlets. He has reported around the world, and he is now covering his fifth federal election campaign. David was born in Montreal. He studied history at the University of Guelph, and as he writes, he likely would have gone to complete postgraduate studies in history, but for the excitement of front page story that his first paper, the twice a week Orange Hill banner. So, encore une fois, merci aux quatre intervenants d'être ici. Et je vais passer la parole d'abord à Alain Roy et je vais vous demander tous les quatre de respecter le 10 minutes.
Bon, merci pour ta gentille présentation. Je veux juste rappeler, avant de commencer, trois choses. Effectivement, je parle en mon nom personnel, pas en tant que. Employé de BAC. Deuxièmement, je suis, malgré moi, en fait, dans cette condition, fonctionnaire du gouvernement fédéral, et donc je ne commenterai pas la discussion sur les monuments, sur le monument du communisme. Vous comprendrez très bien. Et troisièmement, ma présentation va être en français, mais je vais répondre, je peux traduire s'il y a des questions dans les deux langues, aucun problème. Alors, ce que je vais essayer de vous faire, en fait, c'est un peu un tableau d'ensemble du phénomène de la commémoration dans la région de la capitale nationale. Parce que ça manque, en fait, on n'a pas cette perspective-là. Alors, j'ai commencé par cette présentation-là, donc je vais vous donner un peu l'ampleur du phénomène commémoratif et un certain nombre, en fait, de traits qui me semblent d'intérêt pour la discussion. Alors, au total, d'après mes recherches, j'ai cumulé en fait 193 monuments et plaques qui se situent dans la région de la capitale nationale. En fait, il y a 79 monuments comme tels et des plaques de la Commission des lieux de monuments historiques du Canada, il y en a 55. J'ai un certain nombre, je n'ai pas retenu pour mon étude approfondie parce que je m'en étais donné soit sur le moment de la commémoration, c'est-à-dire quand ils ont été appliqués ou quand ils ont été, à quel endroit ils se situent. Alors, si on prend les monuments, en fait, ce qui est d'abord fascinant, c'est qu'on pense en général que les monuments, c'est un phénomène du 19e siècle, mais en réalité, c'est vraiment un phénomène du 21e siècle. En fait, 29% des monuments, en fait, des 79 monuments, donc 23 sur 79 ont été érigés après l'an 2000. Et plus de la moitié, en fait, à partir des années 80. Si on y va rapidement, en fait, en divisant ça par période, avant 1920, en fait, on a 18% des monuments, 14 monuments, c'est-à-dire, c'est ça, 14, dont 8 sur la colline. Donc, il y a une concentration géographique, il y a une concentration aussi des promoteurs, où c'est l'État, donc 86% des monuments avant 1920 sont des monuments qui ont été soit sous la responsabilité des travaux publics ou maintenant de la CCR. La période de 1920 à 1960, elle, c'est la plus faible, en fait, c'est celle où on a le moins. Il y a seulement 13 monuments, ou 16% du total, et on aperçoit un phénomène de dispersion qui commence. C'est-à-dire que là, il y en a quelques-unes au centre-ville de Gatineau. Mais encore là, c'est l'État qui a un rôle majeur pour 75% des monuments. De 60 à 2000, en fait, il y a 35%, Mais là, c'est vraiment intéressant parce qu'il y a vraiment une dispersion encore plus large, c'est-à-dire que c'est plus seulement dans les centres-villes, mais c'est aussi un peu à l'épaule des périphéries. Et les villes vont jouer un rôle plus marqué, c'est-à-dire qu'à cette époque-là, donc en 1960 et 2000, 42% des monuments, c'est des monuments sous la responsabilité soit de la ville d'Ottawa ou de la ville de Gatineau. La période plus récente, elle, est vraiment marquée par un retour de l'État. Donc, 29% au total, donc 47% par l'État, surtout la CCN, en fait, qui est 11 des 23 monuments, et aussi le retour sur le centre-ville d'Ottawa, autour de la commune. Donc, il y a comme un phénomène, si on veut, d'expansion, puis un phénomène de reconcentration qui est intéressant. Si on compare les plaques, par exemple, la Commission des lieux monuments historiques, qui est un autre phénomène, cette édition va être plus tardive et va donc commencer et va être surtout marquée par une présence plus élargie dans le centre du territoire. Maintenant, si on regarde l'ensemble de ces monuments-là, donc je vais me concentrer sur les 79 monuments. En fait, la commémoration, si on la prend comme un phénomène, il y a cinq caractéristiques en fait de débat social autour des monuments. Le premier, c'est la question du langage ou de son expression formelle. Le deuxième, c'est le programme, ce qui doit être commémoré. Le troisième aspect, c'est la localisation, en fait, où on valorise cette commémoration-là. Et la participation aussi dans le processus, donc comment on engage la société civile ou les experts. Un cinquième trait que j'aimerais aborder, c'est la recherche sur la commémoration dans la région. Alors, j'ai 8 constats que je vais partager avec vous. Le premier, bon, si on y va par grand domaine, l'expression formelle. L'expression formelle, en termes, donc, comment la... il y a une constante là-dessus, c'est que depuis le début, depuis, en fait, le monument de quartier en 1885, c'est sous la responsabilité d'un comité consultatif. Donc, il y a une reconnaissance, généralement, que l'expression formelle ne peut être jugée par des pairs. Ça, c'est assez généralisé. Bien qu'il y ait eu des variations dans la forme et la supervision des comités consultatifs. En général, aussi, l'expression formelle n'est pas l'objet de débat, sauf, par exemple, dans le cas du scout Anishinaabe, ou des monuments, entre autres, à Archibald-Wegen et Bennett, en 1966, qui n'ont pas été complétés. Donc, expression formelle. Le programme, j'essaie de... Le programme, il y a trois éléments de programme qui me semblent intéressants à considérer. Le premier, c'est que la commémoration dans la région de capitale n'est pas seulement à destination de consommation canadienne, mais à destination de consommation internationale. Le meilleur exemple de ça, c'est le monument Baldwin-Lafontaine en 1906, parce que ce monument-là est créé. Et quand Lord Grey en parle, il dit « c'est un modèle qu'on veut développer » pour l'Afrique du Sud, qui est en processus de réconciliation. Donc, il y a un élément de consommation internationale. Le monument Glorier, aussi, que en 1927, se passe dans une tournée de l'Empire. En fait, il y a toujours cette dimension impériale-là qui se situe dans la discussion. Deuxième élément du programme, c'est que la mise en place d'un programme commémoratif global est tiraillé entre une volonté de cohérence et des volontés politiques immédiates. C'est-à-dire, ce qu'on va commémorer, c'est comment ça se structure. Au départ, c'était vraiment comme un phénomène, si on veut, ad hoc, suite au décès, par exemple, de Cartier McDonald. Puis après ça, on a voulu contrebalancer avec les libéraux, McGee et Brown. Après ça, donc, il a commencé à se construire un programme qui était centré sur des grands hommes. La royauté, l'Empire, les corps fondateurs, les premiers ministres, les fonctionnaires, deux, mais à la périphérie de la colline, et la rupture qui apparaît en 2000 avec les femmes sur des personnes, c'est-à-dire que c'est pas des personnes, mais c'est des personnes dans le sens plus symbolique. Alors, bien entendu, puis ce qui va arriver, c'est que dans les années 2000, on va chercher, à partir des années 80, 1980, et 2000, on va chercher à développer un programme commémoratif cohérent. Mais, en fait, donc, et ça, c'est le plan stratégique de 2006 qui dit on a besoin de développer des thèmes, on va essayer de développer ça. Mais en fait, il y a une difficulté de mettre en place ce programme-là, qui est celui des volontés politiques quotidiennes. Le document de 1988 de la Commission du capital national est révélateur à cet égard. Il dit « Les procédés qui régissent la sélection et l'installation des monuments commémoratifs de la capitale sont, dans la plupart des cas, des moyens politiques pour le résultat d'un programme. Bien qu'à première vue, il paraisse agir d'un geste impulsif, manquant de vision pour une question de cette importance, il reflète peut-être mieux l'esprit de commémoration en tant qu'expression d'une volonté politique et de valeur publique en évolution. » Bien entendu, on a là un texte qui dit, parce que le mandat de cette étude-là était de dire qu'on ne s'adresse pas au programme. Troisième élément du programme, le fantasme de l'éternité est toujours confronté à la perte de sens. Le fantasme de l'éternité, c'est de croire que parce que c'est dans la pierre, le sens va être là pour toujours. Mais en réalité, ce n'est pas le cas. On a, par exemple, le meilleur exemple, c'est le monument Harper. Pas le premier ministre, mais peut-être un nouveau jour, enfin. Le scout Anishinaabe ou le monument de la révolte du Nord-Ouest, qui aujourd'hui ne serait sûrement pas conçu de la même manière. Alors, on peut tirer trois constats par rapport au programme à la question du fantasme. Le fantasme survient surtout lorsque c'est décidé sous l'impulsion du moment, c'est-à-dire après quelques jours après le décès, on veut commémorer quelque chose en pensant que la signification, elle, va perdurer. On peut aussi penser que le monument seulement ne peut pas porter l'imitation de mémoire, parce qu'on peut, quand on fait un monument, on pense que ça va supporter un changement de culture. Mais le monument seul ne peut porter ces mutations-là parce que pour qu'il vive dans la mémoire, il y a une nécessité de réinjecter du sens, que ce soit par la lecture, la réinterprétation ou en ce qu'on appelle l'effet de réverbération, c'est-à-dire quand la localisation, elle va toujours être un élément, là, les trois autres constats. La localisation, c'est une source de débat continu depuis le début. Et enfin, il y a des plans. Mais bon, ça va toujours rester difficile. La participation, c'est le sixième constat. La poussée vers la démocratisation exige un engagement de plus en plus grand dans le processus. Au début, on dit que ce n'est pas le cas, mais dès 2007, on dit que là, ce qui est critique, en fait, c'est la participation des citoyens. Et ça, c'est un document de la CCN. Donc, la seule chose sur laquelle tous les Canadiens consultés semblent s'entendre est qu'ils préféraient choisir les sujets commémoratifs représentés dans la capitale plutôt que de se les faire imposer. C'est pour me le dire. Osborne et Osborne ont aussi été dans le même sens. Les deux derniers constats sont à propos de la recherche. La première, c'est qu'on est dans une recherche en quête de synthèse. On peut dire qu'il y a eu plusieurs tentatives d'appréhension par des thèses de maîtrise et de doctorat du phénomène global. En fait, il y en a au moins quatre. Et quelques essais globaux, on pourrait penser à la série du Ottawa Citizen, Our Stories in Stone, mais il n'y a pas eu vraiment une appréhension cohérente de l'ensemble du phénomène. Certains monuments, par contre, ont soulevé davantage d'intérêt, particulièrement le Mémorial de guerre, le Monument Champlain, le Médecin de la paix, la colline parlementaire. Il me reste un autre constat qui peut-être va être important, qui va sûrement t'intéresser, c'est qu'il y a un angle mort de l'histoire pour moi. Ce sont les années 20 et la construction de l'identité canadienne. Parce que, en fait, beaucoup de la question identitaire canadienne, elle va se développer dans les années 20. En fait, autour de Mackenzie Kay, mais autour aussi de la communauté historienne. Et cette période-là, elle est vraiment marquante dans l'histoire culturelle canadienne, et pourtant, elle souffre d'anémie d'études, on pourrait dire. Voilà.
Alan Gordon.
Thank you. Merci. Désolé que mon français est un peu trop vieillé, je parle en français, alors I'll begin my talk in English, but I'm happy to misunderstand questions if you don't. But we're talking tonight about commemorations in the national capital, and I think that context of capital cities is important. Capital cities play important roles in any nation, both for the obvious reasons of being the seat of government and centers of political power, and places where governments
provide administrative and legal functions, centralize control of the institutions of order, and in turn control the territories of the state. But they also serve as symbolic or commemorative spaces. They're typically where the country turns to see its history and its ambitions as a nation reflected back at them. And they house not only national institutions, but also many of the nation's symbolic resources. And it's from these symbolic resources, it's city's commemorations, through institutional buildings, monuments, public plazas, bridges, grand boulevards, that we get the special feel of each individual capital city. In other words, they're more than just local architecture and local memorials. Capitals are, by definition, national cities. In other words, there's an accumulation of cultural capital in capital cities beyond what their local populations would produce, as national commemorative resources are redistributed to the center to create a space that means something for the nation as a whole. They create a landscape or a townscape, if you will, a cityscape of commemoration that's meant to reflect the nation back to itself, or at the very least, what some people want to enshrine as the patriotic or national values of the nation. But we need to remember there's more than one model of how a capital should look. In Canada, we tend to compare ourselves to the United States, so Ottawa versus Washington, D.C. But that's not a good comparison. Washington was a planned capital city on a much grander scale than Ottawa. The U.S. is a much larger, far more powerful country than Canada. But just the scale of something like Washington's National Mall, which is 2 miles long and a third mile wide, would look ridiculous in Ottawa Gatton. Moreover, our political institutions don't lend themselves to the division of branches of government that you see in the layout of Washington, D.C., with the Capitol building housing Congress on one end of Pennsylvania Avenue and the White House on the other. Now, two of the questions we were asked to consider for this roundtable were, one, how does Ottawa Gatineau stand out in the North American commemorative landscape? And two, how does Ottawa Gatineau stand out in the national capital commemorative landscape around the world? And I'm not sure these are fair questions. Comparisons are difficult to make, even if Wilfrid Laurier once promised to turn Ottawa into the Washington of the North. Globally, Ottawa doesn't really compare to Paris, to Buenos Aires, even to Mexico City, or the other major capitals when it comes to the scale of its monuments and its grand boulevards or commemorative townscapes. It isn't fair to compare Ottawa to planned capitals like Canberra or Brasilia or New Delhi or Islamabad, because they were laid out to become ceremonial and commemorative townscapes right from the start. London, England, you might say, is similar to Ottawa in that its commemorative spaces were not pre-planned. Even after the Great Fire of 1666, Londoners resisted attempts to build a planned capital city, and its commemorative spaces developed gradually over time. But obviously the size, scale, scope, length of history between the two makes that comparison seem a little preposterous. To be honest, one of the world capital cities that strikes me as similar to Ottawa is Montevideo in Uruguay. Not because they look anything alike, because they don't. They don't look a thing alike in architecture, in urban design, even the people on the streets. But they are both capital cities about the same size who lack grand vistas and obvious focal points. In both cities, you find monuments dominating prominent public squares, but once you walk past them, you disappear again into the city. And it could be virtually any city. You never really get the sense that you're in a capital city. But even that comparison doesn't quite work. Not just because these are totally different places with totally different cultures and histories, but because Ottawa Gatineau actually does have a commemorative precinct and a focal point, although the focus is often kind of blurry. Within this area is where people around Canada expect to see the values of the nation as a whole expressed. Now, it's hard to draw a direct or a definitive boundary around it, but the National Capital Commission's Confederation Boulevard scheme comes relatively close to that commemorative precinct. We have within that area Parliament Hill with its cluster of statues, as I was describing them, the National War Memorial, Nepean Point, Peacekeeping Monument, and important institutional buildings that commemorate them in their own ways. And as a historian who's interested in cities, and especially commemorations in cities, I find this very interesting how it came to be in Ottawa. Ottawa, we know, was a lumber town when it was first selected by Queen Victoria to become the capital in 1857. There was already an existing town, and the function of a capital city had to be grafted onto the side of it. But the government, the country, and the town were too young and too small in the years after Confederation for anyone to really think seriously about commemorations. So the town just grew along existing lines. It was really only the 20th century that people began to consider commemoration. Now, the English historian Eric Hobsbawm has famously identified the period from 1870 to World War I as the era of mass-producing traditions, including a surge in the building of national monuments and planning commemorations.
There's a running joke among Canadian historians that anything that happens in Britain or the United States will happen in Canada, but 20 years later. And in Canada, that mass-producing traditions or commemoration period does run from 1890 to about World War II, fitting that 20-year gap, with the exception of the 21st century, as Alan has just described it. Now, first, only the Parliament buildings distinguish Ottawa from other Canadian towns. It was, and its layout reflected it, a commercial town. The first commemoration was, I believe, the George F. Jan Cartier Monument on Parliament Hill, inaugurated in 1885, and the others on the hill that soon followed it. But the first thoughts about planning for a capital city really only began around the First World War, and planning was interrupted by both the First and the Second World Wars. Now, of course, again, we have to note there's always a distinction, sometimes itself blurry, between planning for a city and planning for a capital. The first is about traffic, sanitation, livability. The second is about civilization. Ottawa's most significant commemoration emerged from this context of trying to plan symbolic spaces within the existing urban environment, a process that produced the National War Memorial and Confederation Square, as we call it today. And despite the efforts of Mackenzie King and his chief planner, Jacques Rébert, Ottawa didn't produce a National Mall or a Champs-Élysées. So what function, then, do commemorations serve in capital cities, with particular reference to Ottawa? To answer that, again, we have to distinguish different types of commemoration. There are living commemorations, such as the annual Canada Day celebrations on the Hill. And there are monumental commemorations, structures and spaces designed to become sites of memory, such as monuments and public squares. These are sites dedicated and decorated in ways that are meant to evoke memories and invoke patriotism. These are places that give the city its symbols. Sometimes these combine, such as a Remembrance Day, and that combination gives the ceremonial spaces increased life. So let's consider first monuments, partly because I'm probably already running. Monuments serve a number of purposes. They're memorials, and they perpetuate memories. They aid civic education by recognizing great leaders and accomplishments. And they're intended to direct our values. They are meant to be forever unchanging. Again, I refer back to that, the phantasm of Kavanaugh that we're talking about. Monuments are meant to be forever unchanging, perpetuating as timeless the values of the people who built them. This, I think, in part, is the reason for the unrest over the current commemorative plans in Ottawa-Gatineau, especially the monument to the victims of communism. It's particularly upsetting for many people. Some oppose the design and the size, and to my mind, quite rightly. Some oppose the site or the locale for the monument, and again, to my mind, quite rightly. And some people oppose its message, saying, you know, basically, where is the monument to the victims of capitalism? All of this and balance it out, as some have asked. Or should we have other monuments in our national capital, things that didn't happen in Canada? Many people simply see this as a monstrously large, not at all universal expression of a particular set of values, not of national values. It doesn't reflect Canada so much as something else to their mind. But this is also troubling because it follows from a commemorative pattern that many people have identified for current government as striking, an attempt to rebrand Canada's values. There's been a celebration of the military, for instance, beginning with the Values Memorial, a curious sort of constituency politics selection of military figures from around Canada's past and around Canada's geography, placed near the National War Memorial. That's one of the Harper government's first commemorative acts in the capital. It was inaugurated 6 months after Stephen Harper first became Prime Minister. More recently, we see the War of 1812 Memorial on Parliament Hill, which was part of an enormous push by the government to turn that war into something it never was. And there'll be more of these monuments to come. To these complaints, although I share them, I respond that commemorations are always political. That's their purpose. They're an attempt to shape values. If I can return again briefly to Uruguay, in one of the main squares of Montevideo, there's an enormous statue of General José Artigas, considered to be the founding father of the country of Uruguay. The monument dates from the late 19th century, but during the military dictatorship of the 1970s, the generals built a mausoleum for Artigas' remains beneath the monument in the hopes of linking their military rule to the image of the favorable founding father and founding general. But unfortunately, Artigas' speeches were all about freedom and liberty, so it kind of backfired on a government, military dictatorships, whose entire purpose was to suppress freedom and liberty. But around the world, we can see this sort of use of commemorations elsewhere. Famous in the French Revolution, even reordered time, changed the names of days and months, and so the calendar would coincide with the revolution, an idea that Khmer Rouge stole for their revolution in the 1970s. The Soviet Union used commemorations of Lenin to support the Stalinist state that followed the Russian Revolution. These uses of commemoration are obviously political and ideology.
And it's for this reason that in unstable countries, monuments are often toppled when the regime changes. But even in stable democratic countries, partisanship plays a role in commemoration. It's just one example. The Ronald Reagan Legacy Project in the U.S. is an effort to name one significant landmark in each of the 50 U.S. states after the 40th president. The initiative is organized by Americans for Tax Reform, a conservative lobby group that opposes any of all tax increases and I believe supports a flat tax. Here in Ottawa, all of the statues of past prime ministers on Parliament Hill were commissioned and inaugurated when their party was in office, with the exception of Lester Pearson.
Well, Rooney's government's responsible for that one.
But other than that, Liberal governments celebrated Liberal prime ministers. Tory governments celebrated Tory prime ministers. It's more subtle, but partisanship still plays a role. Now, just by way of conclusion, because I don't really have one, I'm not arguing that we should accept partisanship in commemoration just because it's always happened. That's not my point. I'm not saying we throw our hands up and say, well, if they want to build it, that's fine, we'll build something else later. But I think understanding that partisanship in politics plays a role in commemoration, truly coming to grasp that concept, will help those who want to argue against it. And understanding the role of commemoration in capital cities in particular will help us to understand the reasons behind the arguments against certain monuments.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and as Eve mentioned, I once hoped to join this profession, but I got sidetracked on this reporter, so that's great to sort of pretend like I'm a history professor at least a few minutes. So I'm going to rip a bit off what Ellen and Alan said. I didn't know that we had sort of 79 monuments, is that? So the Department of Canadian Heritage lists at its website 29 monuments. That's the official government, 29 monuments, 9 of which have been inaugurated or unveiled with this current prime minister. So that's almost one third. And think about this sort of through the Valiance Memorial, the Monument to Fallen Diplomats, that was a gift from the Republic of Turkey a couple of years ago, the Canadian Firefighters Memorial, Animals in War Dedication. Did you know that one was out there? Yes, of course. Royal Canadian Navy Monument, Defense of Hong Kong Monument, Hungarian Monument, Statue of Joe McRae, in addition to the National Artillery Monument. You see the theme here. There isn't a Women Are Persons Monument that the Harper government's responsible for. They're all kind of military. And so my interest as a political journalist, as I look at these, is to say, well, this is just a good point. Yes, it's all political. So what is the point? What is the political objective that political journalists and you guys and voters sort of ought to be aware of? And quite clearly, I think that the mission of the Harper gang has been, since day one, to sort of make them the default party at election time. And of course, that's opposition to being the Liberals were the default party. Liberals were in power, and then they'd be unforgiven, and we'd come back to them after we sat them on the bench. And of course, the Harper guys have been very successful. They've been in power now for almost a decade. And they like Canadians to think of themselves as the default party. And I'm going to veer a little bit, just a bit. This, I think, became most evident when, was a couple of years ago, we had the big anniversary of the Canadian Charter of Rights, was it 40, something like that, I think. And Bob Rae was then leading the Liberal Party, and Bob Rae and all the Liberals got up in the House of Commons and were indignant that the government was not marking this significant anniversary. It's the Charter of Rights, we're crying out loud. How can we not be creating more monuments and doing all sorts of things? And for the Conservatives, the Bill of Rights was a more important document to them. For Liberals, Canadian history has an arc towards the Charter of Rights, and now we're post-Charter period. That's Liberal Canada history. It's all about the Charter of Rights. Conservatives, it's a whole bunch of different things. Bill of Rights had property rights, which was very important to Conservatives. It's conservative-minded people. The Charter of Rights is absent on that particular fact. I asked Tom Mulcair the day that we were celebrating. I said, where are you guys on this one? Democrats, who party without a history, really, until they get in government. Royal Proclamation was more significant for Tom Mulcair because it involved French, English, and First Nations, all sort of as equal people. That sort of started it. That's interesting because as we could see in the Democrats form government this fall, and they will now start to create monuments, and they will start to name buildings after leading lights, Tommy Douglas, airports and museums everywhere, you're sure to see. So I'm interested in how these parties remake Canada to sustain their political narrative. And the Liberals have been fabulous at it. It's one of the reasons they've been, I think, so successful.
So let me just jump around a little bit here. We're going to see some, I think we mentioned this already, we're going to see some new monuments, the National Holocaust Monument, the Communism Monument, the Canadian Building Trades Monument should be unveiled this fall by the Harper government. But then we have some more monuments to our glorious war, making ability, Afghanistan, a Victoria Cross Monument is coming up as well. In terms of commemoration ceremonies, there's two live ones that happen every year that I think are worthy of more thought by me, more thought by perhaps guys in your profession, and that is the Remembrance Day ceremony at the National War Memorial. A decade ago, well, maybe a little more than a decade ago, 12 or 15 years ago, there might be 4,000 or 5,000 people. It wasn't a big event. Peter Mansbridge would not show up to it. Nowadays, 60,000, 70,000, 80,000 people are coming to this thing. It's a very big deal. All three networks, four networks sometimes, broadcasted live, and Mansbridge comes to Ottawa. This is the biggest commemoration event on the Hill. And, of course, it's marking and the achievements or whatever of our Korean War soldiers, our Second World War veterans, but obviously real live veterans from a very hot war in Afghanistan. That, to my mind, how that has changed is interesting, and I'm not sure what to make of it. They're also for the tourists, starting in a couple of weeks, July 1st, I think, there's a show called Mosaica, which is when they light up the center block and they broadcast. It's a 40-minute long, you know, the history of Canada in 40 minutes with lights and sound. It's kind of neat to watch. Kids like it a lot. Well, when the Harper government took over, the current version of Mosaica, a whole lot of Pierre Trudeau canoeing, signing the Charter of Rights, the Queen, a whole lot of Pierre Trudeau. And within about 2 years, that got pulled. And there wasn't really a lot of Trudeau. A lot of Gordon showed up. Perhaps more than he deserved. But nonetheless, it's been changed one more time. Now, that's the Department of Canadian Heritage with the NCC putting that together in consultation. But this is, again, it's partisan politics. It's the government of the day is trying to create a narrative for the tourists that reflects some of its values. And if it's got some values, what are the values that might sustain a conservative government? Paul Wells, my friend, you've got to read his book about the longer I'm prime minister, has a long section in which he talks about the philosophy, political philosophy, perhaps, behind Stephen Harper's conservatives. Sort of a Burkean thing, where social cohesion is more important, social stability is more important, the group is more important than what you would think sort of classical liberal philosophy, where it's all about the triumph of the individual, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. That's classic liberals. And that's why I think a lot of these monuments we're seeing has to do with promoting or remembering works that preserve this social cohesion, this social stability. That would be more important. Just to touch on some of the questions you asked us to look at, one of the starkest differences between this capital and the American capital for me is the American capital, is there any First World War monuments in the main major First World War monuments? No, because that wasn't much of a war for them. It's a big deal, that war for us, the center block, the Peace Tower. It's the most iconic, what does Ottawa stand for? That's a World War I monument. The National War Memorial, built, of course, to honor the First World War. That, to me, that's the biggest difference in U.S. and Canada. It's World War I is the First World War, the Great War, is a real big deal for us. John McRae, we're talking about that right now. How does Ottawa stand out in the national commemorative landscape around the world? You ask this, one answer to that, we have a long way to go. I travel a lot with the Prime Minister, so he's been around the world. I'm in the back of his airplane, wherever he goes. And wherever he goes, almost the first thing he does when he's visiting a national capital is he goes to a war memorial. He lays a wreath at a war memorial. That is almost the first thing he does. I've been with him twice to Hong Kong. We've been to the cemetery, the Siwan Cemetery, that's where the Second World War folks are buried. He's done that twice. The only other cemetery he's done twice would be Vimy. He's done that twice as well. He gave the best speech I've ever seen him give at the 90th anniversary of Vimy a couple of years ago, because he really likes this stuff. He wrote it himself, he's really into it. But wherever we go, there's going to be that component in the official program. And interestingly, whenever someone comes here, we just had the Dutch royal family here over the week, first thing they do when they come to Ottawa, you go to the War Memorial and you lay a wreath. And that, again, just coming back to the whole idea that this is what we want to celebrate, or these are the things that, that bind our nation to other nations, is fighting for whatever it may be.
What else did I want to just touch on here?
That's about it. So for the purpose of our discussion, I hope you use me as a resource to talk about the intersection of politics, how we're celebrating history, how we're not celebrating some kinds of history. And one of the things I hope to use to this discussion for is to then write about it and ask more of the New Democrats, of the Liberals, and continue the Conservatives, how they plan to try and achieve political ends by getting Canadians to think about their history, their monuments, et cetera, et cetera, differently.
Thank you.
So I think that was actually a good segue to my opening talk. So two things I'd like to do, to shift things a little bit, is to actually step outside of the National Capital Region for a few minutes and to actually go westward to Winnipeg, where there's the newly opened Canadian Museum for Human Rights, and you can see a picture of it in the background over here. And then in front of it, this is a picture I took, I believe it was November 2012, when the museum was still being built, so a still construction site, and this was one of the posters that was surrounding the museum, in which it says, I don't know if you can see it, small there is the conversation has begun. So in addition to going west for the first part of my talk, I also want to think about the work, the politics, the meanings that are generated by memorials as well as memorial museums such as this one that go beyond the concrete or the stone pillars of the actual structure. So just as a very quick kind of research biography that I can give you is I started doing research on the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, and I was interested primarily in the debates going on as to which histories were going to be included in the museum and which ones were being omitted and who was angry and who was feeling left out. And primarily I was looking at some of the Ukrainian community groups that were protesting the fact that the Stalinist-led famine against the Ukrainians, referred to sometimes as Holodomor, was not receiving as much attention as the Holocaust, the Nazi genocide of the Jews in the museum. Fast forward a few months, I then started to hear about these debates going on in Ottawa about the Victims of Communism Memorial, and at the same time there was another new memorial going up, Victims of the Holocaust. And I was surprised or just interested in potential parallels between these. And I started to think about Canada as a broad memorial landscape, not located only in Ottawa, but also with some arms to the west in this case. And I was curious to know if any of the debates that were happening here were being replicated in Ottawa. And interestingly, all of the debate has been focused on the Victims of Communism Memorial, and not much is being said about the Holocaust Memorial. I've shifted west, and then the second thing, as I said, that I wanted to do is also to focus on the discourse, the conversation, the debate that emerges from these physical structures, and I thought this signpost was an interesting, both metaphorical and also literal, invitation to think about these debates and conversations. And namely, I'm going to give a couple of examples in terms of protest, so conversation in the form of protest, grassroots protest. So here's a more complete image of the CMHR, Canadian Museum of Human Rights, upon opening. Just quick background, this was opened in Winnipeg, Manitoba, but this past September 2014, the first national museum to be opened outside of the National Capital Region. So again, an interesting link to Ottawa, but geographically separate from it. And this project took more than 10 years to complete. One of the reasons is because there were many debates and conflicts between different community groups, the government, curators, and developers in the museum in regards to this question of what's being included and what's being excluded. One of the debates that has been going on has been with First Nations communities. There are a whole number of issues coming out of First Nations communities' protests of these museums, of this museum, but one community I want to focus on in particular is the Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation. So this is a community of approximately 300 people near Kenora on the provincial border between Manitoba and Ontario, and they're situated about 160 kilometers east of Winnipeg. This is going to become relevant in just a minute. So this community, this First Nations community, was artificially transformed into an island back in 1919 when the city of Winnipeg needed to build a viaduct to get a clean water source. So this island was, at that point, artificially created. And as a result, the people living on that island, it was a First Nations community, lost access to clean water, ironically enough, and have been trying since then to find a clean water source, to get the government to provide that to them, as well as build safe road access. They've been protesting for years, and you can change the slide. But in fact, they've gotten the most media attention, I believe, in the past year, when they decided to align their protests with the opening of the Canadian Museum of Human Rights, when they launched the Museum for Canadian Human Rights Violations. So clear parallel, playing on the name of the CMHR. And they launched their project about 5 days before September 19th or 20th when the CMHR in fact opened. And this emblem, this is the official emblem of the Canadian Museum for Human Rights Violations. You see the CMHR in one corner connected very directly to Shoal Lake, the island of Shoal Lake, via a pipeline that literally sucks out the water. So one of the major protests of the Shoal Lake community is not just to try to rally for safe road access from the government as well as fresh water, but also to protest the museum directly because they feel that their ongoing human rights violations are not being respected and represented in the museum itself. And even more more offensively, one of the main areas of the CMHR is called the Garden of Contemplation, which celebrates water and has a whole bunch of mini pools. And I mean, obviously, because Winnipeg's main water source comes from this lake, the water used in those pools to celebrate the power, the contemplative power of water, comes from this community. And there's actually no reference anywhere in the museum to the fact that the water is being taken from there. This example is simply to show a form of noise that's being generated from the concrete structure of a national museum. It's giving additional momentum to a grassroots organization trying to protest both the local, federal, as well as provincial governments for very specific things. Moving now back east to Ottawa, the national capital region, I recently found out about another analogous protest group that was using a planned official national monument to put forward to protest against that. So this is the Facebook page of a group called Entrepreneurs du Commun. They're a collection of mostly Quebecois artists and intellectuals. They are quite offended, as many people seem to be, about the plans for a Victims of Communism memorial. And they got together and decided to put forward a call for proposals for a monument, a memorial to liberty. And I'm going to just quickly read to you their what it said on their call for proposals. So the call for a proposal seeks to stimulate critical reflection around the Canadian Victims of Communism memorial. The aim of monuments to the victims of liberty is to question the conservative government's ideological instrumentalization of the concept of liberty in the lead-up to next year's federal elections. According to the Harper government, and I quote, Nazism, Marxism, Leninism, today, terrorism, they all have one thing in common, the destruction, the end of human liberty, end quote, and that's a quote from Stephen Harper, 2014. Faced with such gross historical confusions and ideological simplifications, we pose the following questions. Are there victims of liberty? If so, who are they? Do totalitarian forms of liberty exist? What makes the Harper government's particular brand of Canadian freedom so distinctive? Can we make public the lapse between how such freedom is defined and how it is executed? So all of that is from the official call for proposals that this group put forward back last summer. And in September, the deadline for the call for proposals saw about 30, I think it was 28, 28 proposals were submitted, and they're planning a big exhibit this coming September in Gatineau in an art gallery, hoping to align to be close to the federal election as a way, and also probably the opening of the victims, or the inauguration of the Victims of Communism Memorial as planned. So again, another example of noise that's generated around an official plan an official monument and the protests that goes along with it. And finally, my very modest attempt at also generating some public discussion, which unfortunately I believe failed a little bit. This is an op-ed I wrote last month. It was published in the Ottawa Citizen. And the byline there is, not the byline, but the title kind of sums up what I'm trying to talk about today. Memorials are built out of public discussion and debate as much as they are out of concrete and stone. And my main point is that we may have some gripes with these official places. What is the ideology behind it? What is the government trying to push forward? But I think there's so much value in the conversations being generated and the debates and the new ideas being put forward. And so I ask, why is nobody saying anything about the Holocaust Memorial? And I'm not necessarily saying that we should not have this monument, but at least to spark some sort of debate, a national debate. It doesn't necessarily have to be quite as vicious as the victims of communism debate has been, but to just start thinking through how does this monument fit into the Harper government's bigger project of commemoration, as my fellow panelists have discussed here, and what ideas are we potentially missing out on by not having this discussion as well? So I will leave off
with
that.
Merci. Avant de passer à la deuxième étape de notre événement, où les panélistes vont discuter entre eux, je voudrais peut-être très rapidement évoquer un aspect qui n'a pas été évoqué. Je vais le faire en parlant de la Commission de la capitale nationale. En 2009, avec d'autres historiens, j'ai été invité à participer à un comité consultatif sur la commémoration dans la capitale nationale. It had been created by Mark Christmanson, who was at the time who is a historian, who was the director of public events at the public programmation at the National Capital. Now Mark is the head of the Commission de la Capitale Nationale. And the idea is that he wanted to have some expert advice, but it's interesting that the people that formed themselves on the committee, this new committee in 2009, were myself, Mark Conrad from New Brunswick, Leipzig. And it was Tom Simons, because Tom Simons is like the statesman of commemoration in Canada, because Tom Simons was for many years president of the National Commission des Monuments, Lieux et Monuments Nationaux du Canada. And then Jim Miller joined us, who is a leading, from the West, who is a leading Aboriginal historian. And the idea was that the National Commission wanted to get away from military history and political history to include themes. And this is why we were there. We were, except for Tom Simon, we were all social historians. But it was not so much a question of politics at the time in 2009. It came later. In 2009, finally, the process doesn't allow very much groups that have been, let's say, marginalized to participate, because there is a question of money. There is a question of also it's a complex process to bring forward a file. So it will be very difficult for a group that doesn't have much social capital or much capital to go forward. And this was the main reason why it has been a failure. But there was no. Not too many social commemorations of that deal with the social history. Alors, j'aimerais maintenant repasser la parole à nos panélistes. You see really a continuous line rather than a big change that, you know, I think the general public and maybe some of us, we think that with the Harper government, it's something completely that is quite new in the commemoration. So, do I oversimplify by saying that?
Yes, in some way. For sure, there's some continuity. For example, the question of formal expression is something. There were some stuff that weren't, you know, but started in the 19th century, it still continues. But in fact, the main question for me, or the main changes, is in the process, in the fact that people are asking and the question of being part of the decision-making process. This is the push for democracy. There was expert committees, but more and more, this was recognized by the National Capital Commission that there is a need to have this as a public discourse, but also get some consensus. And in fact, Osborne and Osborne mentioned it. It's a question of the value of the long. If you want a monument that is long-lasting, it has to be built on some consensus. Nowadays, in fact, what we see is more like a polarized debate, not really a real debate for the, you know, it's something that you're for or against, and not really getting something that people will agree upon at the end of the process. So, in fact, the long life, this will fail in the long term because there won't be this large consensus between people that this is the right stuff. So, the push for democracy is there, and is also, it's all something that is also always in the progressing, in fact. Second point is also the policy game, and I refer back to what David mentioned. In the name, it's interesting to see how the political parties played the commemoration game in the 90s, because at that time, and it was like Mackenzie King was there, and he wanted, you know, having this big show about Laurier and the Confederation place. But at that time, he wanted to move some monuments from, I think it's Mackenzie, but he wanted to put Mackenzie on one end and Laurier at the other end. And he asked that to Megan, and Megan said, no, I don't agree with that. So the plan for Mackenzie King was just scrapped, because there was this consensus between the parties on the Parliament Hill. So there's, I think also this polarization is what we are seeing now. It's a bit different from what happened. So this is some, it's still the question of getting a more consensus, I think. No.
Want to add something?
Well, we don't tend to concur. I mean, there's that continuity that there's always been this struggle over monuments or commemorations and how they're to be done, but there have been moments when there's a consensus about sort of a broad base and consensus about certain ideas. But it's the kind of polarization we're seeing today. I don't think it is all that new. I think it's just returning again. In the same way that I think the conservative government's actually returning to the older style monumentalization, older style commemoration, trying to build it around stone and bronze monuments rather than building it around community involvement or the kinds of commemorative institutions like gardens, like parks, things like that that are more daily use. And that's what I think is a little bit interesting about this current way since about 2000 is this return to an older style, which is going with an older style polarization that we see in the 19th century, not so much in the 20th century. In the 20th century, I think Canadians have generally built up a consensus about what needed to be commemorated. It was war, but that was because the war touched so many people so personally. The First World War in particular, but also the Second World War following that. Recently, I think it's part to do with the way politics have gone, partisan politics in particular. They have deliberately polarized our discussions. And when you do that, you're suspicious of everything that comes out of that, and that includes decisions to commemorate. There's a continuity, but there are also significant differences as well.
David or Metin, would you have something to add?
Well, one of the things I do, part of my political work, is I try and track every time the government stands up and spends money. Any given day, there's probably a press release that goes this way. MP so-and-so, on behalf of Minister so-and-so, is pleased to announce a check for so-and-so money for whatever it is. And there's all sorts of government programs. The budget is one thing. The government says, in the budget, we're going to spend, let's say, $25 million on, to give you an example, the New Horizons for Seniors projects. And that is a system where if you have a seniors group in your community, you can apply to Employment Service Canada and get up to $10,000 to fix up your senior center. So I track the actual checks when they show up. They've approved the project.
there's been about, I'm right now, my database has about 6,000 such announcements since the last election. Again, this is all sorts of spending. One of the spending programs, you recall, we had this infrastructure spending to create jobs, the economic action plan. And there was a lot of announcements. I'm going to build a bridge. I'm going to build a, fix up a rec center, fix up an arena. Well, Veterans Affairs got a whole pile of money to fix up cenotaphs. You may have seen this. And this is right across the country. Not only fix up cenotaphs, usually these are small check amounts, $1,000 a year, $8,000 a year, depending on where it's at. This is the national capital program, it seems to me, driven down to the grassroots. Bernard Lord, the former Premier of Brunswick, once said to me that as a politician, he got a lot more political mileage for showing up at a senior's home or a cenotaph with a $1,000 check for whatever group than he did showing up to say, I'm going to build a $25 million overpass. More little checks are way more valuable to a politician on the stump. So I just throw that out. Then there's the new ones, too, that I just did some ATI work because I wanted to see the thinking behind the bureaucratic government thinking behind establishing new commemoration sites. Is anybody from Beaconsfield, Montreal, any chance? There's one called Heroes Park. This is about a year and a half old. And it was a military person who thought the idea we need something here in Beaconsfield and made some applications to the Department of Canadian Heritage. And there was a lot of paperwork. And the ATI request, I just got back a couple months ago, we haven't had a look through it. This thing is like 900 pages. It's a relatively small amount of money to create this thing, but it's government. So this is sort of the policy government is taking, the conservative government is taking this national capital military commemoration and it's sort of pushing it out. And just one other thing, too, in terms of the things that I think, Alan, you mentioned, I wrote this down, expect to see the values of the nations expressed in your national capital. Absolutely. What are the values of the nation? And this current conservative government believes that this capital is built on the values of the Laurentian elite. You've read the book by my friend Bricker and whatever, the Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto axis, that this is a capital that expresses the values of the Laurentian elite. And if there's one government that is not going to be dominated whatever by the Laurentian elite, it's this one. And so, if the Laurentian elite hates the victims of communism memorial, then by God, we're doing something right. That is the mindset. It's sometimes a little dopey, but that's the way they think. They absolutely think if everybody in Ottawa hates what we're doing, by God, we're on the right track. That's your government in action.
I can't ask
that. Nadine, you have like the other panelists, you didn't have much, we didn't give you much time. Can you elaborate a little bit on how you see it, because you alluded to it, the relationship between monument to the victims of communism and the Holocaust monument?
Sure. So one thing that I'm surprised by, and I did allude to this, is that in the building of the CMHR, one of the major debates was really two Ukrainian community groups regarding this question of the so-called dominance of Holocaust representation over their own suffering under their own history of suffering under Stalinism. And I find it interesting that you have these two monuments being built here in Canada, in Ottawa, one to the Holocaust and one to the victims of communism. And there are quite a few actually Ukrainian community groups involved with that, as well as Polish and Vietnamese and many other cultural groups across Canada who are involved with the victims of communism monument. And I find it interesting that there's no actual direct dialogue between those two. Forget the fact that there isn't a bigger dialogue about the Holocaust monument, but between these two, in fact, nobody seems to be speaking to each other. And to transpose that onto the European continent, where these things actually happen, there are major debates over there constantly under the context of what is referred to as a victim of competition of victimhood, this idea of who suffered more, victims of the Holocaust or victims under communism. And these are really important debates going on in Europe. And I find it interesting that transposing these monuments that refer back to those two histories here in Ottawa have not in any way seemed to replicate any of those conversations in a way that they did westward, they did out west. Otherwise, more pragmatically, there are important similarities. disparities between these two monuments in terms of timeline, in terms of them both being projects at the NCC. They're very close to each other in Ottawa. They will be, you know, there is definitely some geographic symbolism. They will be speaking to each other in terms of, in the context of the landscape of the city. And I'm looking and trying to hear something being said about that.
Can I ask a question to the panel? Maybe you can start with this. I'm curious about the role of donors, both with the Museum of Human Rights and the two new proposed monuments, and whether they are influencing the debate about what is going to be emphasized. And the emphasized, I mean, I used to work with the Jaspers, and I know that was their project, the Museum of Human Rights. So I don't know if you've had any thoughts or thoughts on that.
So that's a really good question. I know that one of the big points of contention with the Victims of Communism monument is that there's so many political people standing behind, like Minister Penny, who is a big champion of this weather. I don't think funds have actually come from this ministry, but
he's helpful probably raising funds and getting people to check
so. And kind of gives a certain authority to the project as such. More than that, I don't know how much of an influence donors would actually have, but I imagine there is some relationship that overtly.
Wasn't our election campaign in 2011? They campaigned.
But in fact, it's related to the point Mac mentioned before that we don't put money in just waiting for dollars. So in fact, the problem of balance that we will be always a problem because other issues, who will raise money for social. Aboriginal people,
but with both monuments, there is a matching, like a matching fund system in place where the government offers a certain amount. I think, maybe $4.5 million or $5.5 million. I think for each one, and then there was the expectation that the donors would raise, like these private tribute to liberty, yep. And actually forget now the name of the organization running the Holocaust monuments, but also a conglomeration of private donors that they would match.
Well, I think I've been to some dinners where, if not the Prime Minister, Jason Kenney, these are big elaborate dinners that are served as political events as well as fundraising events as well as Golden Arrow events. It's very money sort of things.
Having been on the committee that studied the proposal for this particular monument, I can tell you that they were very adamant. Because the committee, it has become public because Don Butler in The Citizen wrote pieces about that. And the committee, we were unanimously against not the idea, but the particular formulation of the monument. We tried to convince them that it should be larger than that, victims of totalitarianism. We're just an advisory committee, and so the board of the National Capital, thought otherwise. They tried to compromise, but in the end, this is the government that it's the same thing for Commission des lieux et monuments historiques. It's a political decision at the end. Je pense qu'on va maintenant passer la parole. Je suis sûr que la discussion a été fascinante. Je pense qu'il y a sûrement des questions et des commentaires. Robert.
Ah oui, merci Yves. Tu as fait la remarque au début. This government's one of their objectives is they want to become the national government party of Canada. That was me. I wonder how much recognition or understanding is there that these projects are. We've talked about, of course, commemoration has always been political, but I think there's a sort of a hyper-partisan aspect to what's been going on. And very specifically, how much acknowledgement is there that these monuments are, that these projects are very, very targeted and targeted, but not just at creating a new broad consensus of how Canadians think about their country, but also targeting specific voting groups, voting blocks, and I'm talking about ethnic cultural groups here. And it was mentioned that Jason Kenney's been involved in these projects, and he was one of their main guys in winning and stealing the ethnic cultural vote from the Liberals. And if you look at who these projects appeal to, conservative Ukrainians, maybe Jewish voters. These are some of the ethnic cultural groups that the conservatives have made little secret about the fact that they're targeting. Do you think there's much understanding about this, or is this something that has been talked about, or that you've heard of, kind of, you know, maybe in passing that, yeah, this is going to get us the goals that we need with these specific groups? And how does that compare to about that kind of very targeted kind of political activity to the more broad sort of partisanship or political nature of commemoration of the past?
I can jump in. I mean, I think you put your finger directly on what I think is the big difference in the 21st century commemoration as opposed to the politics of the period. I think they are running election campaigns. Even mentioned it in the actual platform, I didn't realize that. But you're right, I mean, there's sort of that unspoken recognition that this is an extension of Keeney's strategy of going after the particular ethnic cultural groups. I've heard that expressed many, many, many times, but sort of look how to say it, it doesn't work its way into any sort of newspapers or research articles, but it's sort of that sort of, yeah, we recognize that's what's going on, but we don't say that directly.
Yeah, but it's hard to.
Yeah, the 15 minutes prior to question period is called Member Statements. Standing Order 31 is called SO 31s. And I very much enjoy watching SO 31s because this is when MPs and staff can talk for a minute about anything they want. Vladislav Lison is trying to be reelected in a Pickering area, right? What was he, Pickering? Somewhere in the GTA. He's from Poland. And he spoke about this communism because he lived under it, and any time he could talk about it, it's great. Mark Adler is trying to get elected in the North Center. Mark's Jewish. Mark was the one, I was there, two feet from him, he was at the Whaley Wall in Jerusalem, and he said, this is the $1 million shot. Did you remember what that was? Yeah. That's Mark Adler. nice fellow, but it's a dumb thing to say. Mark's Jewish, and so certainly it's a Jewish component, right? He's got a lot of Russians as well in his run. They lived under communism. Cornelius Chizu, he's definitely Pickering. He's from Romania. Parker's been to Romania. He talked about communism, blah, blah, blah. Then we talk about the biggest communist government in the world, China. And now we're talking the whole Pacific Coast narrative. Alice Swan, our Minister of State for Seniors, and the New Horizons Senior Center, she's up for re-election in the riding of Richmond. Richmond's definitely in play versus the Liberals. And there's a whole lot of ridings in the lower mainland that are in play. So those already, and for the last year, there's a whole lot of members of the conservative benches who have lived and been victims of communism, which are already talking sort of about this. So, there's no question about it. But again, you know, I don't know that you can say this is a conservative only thing. And that's why I come back to the debate we had about the Charter of Rights, where all these liberals were standing up and they couldn't understand why on earth you guys can't get it, but the Charter of Rights is like us. Because that's what they have talked about, and they have history on that, and that's theirs. And again, the Democrats at this point, you know, I'm trying to think if there's, you know, particular moments in history besides, of course, the Tommy Douglas and healthcare and all that.
And of course, it's always commemoration's always been political.
Yeah, but
it's so targeted, so focused.
Well, you're absolutely wrong. Yeah, on that one, communism. You know, I gave you those specifics. So yeah, those are writings that are all in play, and every writing's going to count this fall.
But it's also an international statement. So it's not only internal politics, it's also a statement about how Canada is behaving on the international scene. You know, the same for peacekeeping. We don't talk a lot, more about the peacekeeping stuff, but now it's this kind of monument. And this is, for me, it's not only like a policy statement or a policy thing. I think it's not my comment, but I mean that we also have to think that our government is also playing a game on the international scene about the way Canada should be seen or should act. And this is a kind of statement in that sense.
Shit.
Okay, I guess I agree with what you just said, Alain, because it's, I think it goes beyond political advantages at home, because talk about overkill with the size of the thing and the emplacement of it. And I think that goes beyond our borders. I mean, it's bam, you know, this is it, and we're...
Of both monuments.
Yeah.
You know, when Nadine was talking about, there was the debate about the Holocaust memorial size.
Absolutely. And Nadine, you mentioned the lack of discussion about the whole thing. And somebody, I was talking to somebody recently, and they mentioned the fact that as a population, we're growing old. And I think that in terms of, you know, doing something about things, older people tend to be more relaxed and less in your face. And you think that that plays a part in the lack of debate, not only on that, but I mean on many issues in society now.
But how much of this is sort of the nature of Ottawa, when we say that NCC is sort of giving its go ahead or maybe not, and the city of Ottawa is protesting with this kind of power, sort of these weird dynamics of Ottawa and the federal government within Ottawa? Is it, would we see the same thing
well, there was recently last week, wasn't it? I'm going to confuse parties here, but wasn't the local politicians of Ottawa, wasn't there a vote against? Jim Watson has spoken out very directly against the monument, and I'm not sure what effect that actually will have.
City is meant to be national, it's the national government. So holds this will. And Ottawa has since about the Civil War. Prior to that it involved the city of Ottawa. But since the First World War the federal government has in fact sort of decided that it's gonna do what it wants to do in Ottawa. And in Ottawa they just basically accept it and say thank you.
Again, there might be more follow. I'm just trying to think. In the early days of the Harper government, there was some debate about a Canadian portrait gallery. And a lot of people, you know, we shut down the photograph of the Canadian National Photographic Museum Gallery, whatever. And there was discussion to put it in Calgary. And a lot of people had a discussion with lots of op-eds about it's the capital. You put your national museums in the capital. You don't put one in Calgary and one in wherever. You know, knowing the way, just the way some conservatives think is, the pushback they're getting on this communism memorial, may not get built if they don't form government in a few months. It won't be too late. Somebody can change their mind. But if the conservatives are in, you can see them saying, you know, yeah, just to show Ottawa, we're going to put the portrait gallery in Calgary. Or, you know, that's the sort of thing they do. I mean, the conservatives are quite willing to just shake it up, just fun, spite, and sometimes they have a good reason behind it. The Democrats as well are also, I think, you know, ready to look at different ideas and different ways to mark our patrimony as well. It may not be so mean-spirited or vicious or so overtly political, but it will be because they want to do something different than the Liberals, which is both those parties are quite keen to do something, anything different than Priscillian Liberals.
To add about, I think the relationship between the capital organization form of government and the city is not always an easy one. And even here in Ottawa, you know, a year ago there was like big fights between not only the mayor, Jim Watson, but also the ethno mayor with NCC about different things. And one was about the closing of the street on the north side, on the Latino side. There was the question of a transit way, etc. So, and this wasn't an easy because the idea of a capital is like something more symbolic, and then there was a vision of themselves against the citizen. This is not always the case in every city, but there's often this kind of fight. For example, but another example is Quebec City, which has also a capital function, and all there were also some issues about, you know, about buildings and commemorations, etc. So the same issue arose. One example of social, there was an example, a clear example of political issue with commemoration there. There was in 1918 the Easter massacre. In fact, four people were killed by the army. And there was a big fight to have a monument about it, and it was a long story. Citizens paid for it, and this was like something. It took time for the citizen community to get the monument.
When was this debate? Right after the event.
What we done is in the 19th. In fact, this monument was unveiled in the 90s, and it took 10 years, maybe, to get the money.
Mm-hmm. Dernière question, Marcel, commentaire.
I have two different questions. I've lived in Trump, in Ottawa, you know, between 1990 and 1998, and at the time we did not have many monuments. I'm surprised that now we have 79 monuments. First question, where are all those monuments? Are we running out of space? And if we are running out of space, are we invading other parts of the city that have not been invaded? Second question, time we talk about Ottawa, we forget there's something. And I like, Alan, what you said, you know, there is a city, but there is also a capital. And unless I'm mistaken, since the 60s, you know, the federal government has tried to integrate New Hall. And to what extent Hall, which is now getting it, has been integrated in the development of the capital? In other words, how many monuments do we have on the other side of the river? I know the one, obviously, Shah, but besides that one, how many more monuments? Then all those monuments, where are they? Are we running out of space? And what are we doing with Hall? Is Hall part of developing, you know, capital?
We're not. First, I reassure you, we're not running out of space. In the 88 the report.
Then we can have a monument to the victims of Stephen Harper.
I think. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
In 1966, in fact, it was the first plan for the hill. We planned like 25 more monuments just on the problem on the hill. So, yes. And this is all the monuments. So all these most places are still, most of them are still empty. So they feel some, you know, with monument. And there are a few in all. So I haven't a list with here. But one of the oldest one is one to, for example, you have one Champlain.
Il y en a au moins une quinzaine, en fait, au total. Et Maurice Richard, c'est le gouvernement du Québec ou le gouvernement canadien?
Maurice Richard, actuellement, c'est sur une propriété de la Commission de capital national.
Okay.
Maurice Richard, de toute façon, est un héros canadien-français dans ce qu'il y a de plus canadien-français
de l'époque. Okay. There is another one, just because I'm not the site, but Never Again War, Monument Peace and Remembrance, 1992. In Gatineau, but I mentioned the 29 that was at the Department of Air's website, and it's just that, and then Maurice Richard, the only two.
For example, you don't have in this list the monument, it's a monument of the 20s. In fact, there are several like this.
Nowadays, there is, I don't remember exactly what are the categories, but they are two categories. One's, you know, the National Commission, let's say that you want to commemorate your grandfather, you know, the National Commission will determine if it should be a national commemoration, then there are some spaces in the city and they are three categories, and sometimes there is a contention there with, of course, the promoters always think that their cause is the most worthwhile.
Mais la liste, elle viendrait, les 79 dont je parlais, c'est la liste qui était en partie fournie par la CCM, plus une recherche, en fait, dans, à la fois dans les listes de monuments de la ville de Gatineau, qui en a déjà une dizaine de nommés, plus d'autres. Fait que, donc, mais il y a encore de la place et beaucoup de monuments.
Last, right.
Okay, well. Something that David mentioned in passing that I know a little bit about, which is the Quilting Trades Commemoration. Because 2 years ago, I was brought up to Ottawa for a day-long consultation, and nothing for months, for 2 years almost. I assumed it was dead. But I've been invited to a jury for the actual movement forward to put the plans on it in June, later this month. So how does that happen? That seems like an outlier in this whole process. I mean, I know the building trades are willing to put a lot of money into this, but it seems to apply against all of the trends that people have been talking about.
I think that, if I remember this, what happened to this one, first of all, the first proposal, we sent it back because it was the rationale for it, l'argumentaire, left much to be desired. So they went back and maybe they talked to you, I don't know, but they had to other labor historians, and then they came back with a better, with a much better proposal. But then there is the question, I remember there was an issue about the money, and then it gets into the bureaucracy, and it takes a lot of time, because I don't remember exactly how it works, but they have, it's not only that they have to build the monument, they have also to bring some money or to engage some money that they will contribute to the maintenance. It was a long process. Certainly, they didn't have the same backup as for. Oh, there are two monuments.
2017, right? So, you may know more about this. But it also contains political language that this will be about all the buildings trades people who helped create the
vote for us. I'm just saying.
And then, David, can you tell us more about all those monuments?
You know what? That, in fact, you're doing some reading about this today. That would be a great list to compile. I only know of two, and I'm sure there's many, many more quite across the country. So that's something I hope to do some work on. Talk about, write about, etc.
So just to answer your question about the team, in 2007, 61 monuments, and they used the Parks Canada's framework to 73% are related to policy life, political, to cultural life, 21% to social life, and 1.6% to the economy. So even if there's one out of there, you know, this is still, the frame is still a vessel. And even more, I think most of the more recent monuments are more on the political side or theme than others.
And what has happened now the committee still exists, but it's an ad hoc committee, and we have not been called for a while. Anyway, it's not the National Capital Commission that is responsible now for public programmation. It's under the Ministry of Heritage. And they don't respect, for instance, the problem with the victims of communism is that one of the criteria is that it has involved Canadians at the time, or that it is on Canadian soil. For the victims of communism, it doesn't apply. And another criteria is the one on Afghanistan. They're supposed to be, maybe you know, Alain, I don't remember the exact number of years, but there should be a number of years before a monument, before the event has happened, before it would be a monument. So this criteria has been out of the window. The most famous, until now, the most famous exception, but it's not contentious at all, it's Oscar Peterson.
Well, actually, the National War Memorial was altered last year, just before Remembrance Day. Mm-hmm. It used to say, if you know, well, it says 39 to 45 and 14 to 11, and it's just added 2001 to 2011, mm-hmm. Afghanistan and the Korean War, and that created a huge stink. The Legion was upset because it's too close for Afghanistan to show up on the national level.
And they added the last one that was killed, you know, I think, in the last program.
Yes.
They added them to the monument, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
Malheureusement, il va falloir terminer la soirée parce que we have to vacate the room by 10, so we have 9 minutes to vacate the room. Alors, je voudrais remercier beaucoup nos 4 panélistes. Vous avez vu que ça complétait très, très bien. Ça a été...
You've been listening to a recording of Commemorations in the National Capital Region, Evolution and Findings. This roundtable was chaired by Yves Frenette and was held as part of the Canadian Historical Association annual meeting. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.